This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 17. And I'm delighted to be joined on the show today by Samad Masood, Open Innovation Lead at Accenture UK, and yet another member of the London Financial News FinTech 40 to appear on the show. In LFP 012, we discussed the gluing of fin and tech together. In LFP 014, we discussed how accelerators can facilitate bridging between existing financial services organisations and the new fintechs. Samad knows a lot about this, having run Accenture's FinTech Innovation Lab in London. More broadly, the FinTech stone has been lobbed into a very large pool, and the ripples have spread far. Accenture is a multinational management consulting, technology services and outsourcing company. Measured by revenues, the world's largest consulting firm and has over 300,000 staff. Notwithstanding this large oil tanker scale, it has proved remarkably nimble and agile in orientating itself to the new world. Its reports on fintech investment patterns are the most widely quoted of all. It was perhaps the first to set up a fintech accelerator program in New York in 2012, working closely with the Partnership for New York City Fund. Since then, they have extended the model to London, Hong Kong, and now Dublin. So if my overriding theme is that the fintech revolution requires old FS to get sexier and new FS to get more solid, then in the consultancy space, Accenture are well ahead. At an individual level, Samad is a great strategic thinker, all too rare in this world of BS come PRE, so-called thought leaders. His deep background as a technology journalist and then researcher have given him a rare ability to see the deeper patterns beneath the froth. Furthermore, he's also a top bloke. It was an interesting experience for me earlier in the summer, essentially being of no status whatsoever in either the podcast world or on the fintech scene. I rather felt like a wandering Taoist who conceals his knowledge under his rags. Some folks, but pleasingly not too many, the tech scene is indeed democratic and friendly, were only too happy to be patronising. Most were friendly. But few actually went out of their way to be helpful to someone with apparently nothing to offer and only requests to make. When I first met Samad, despite him having another meeting to go to, he kindly escorted me to the lift and gave me some very useful advice about journalism, a subject that, like most, I know nothing about. If only I could remember what the advice was, by now I would no doubt be much further ahead than I am. I say this not to embarrass Samad with praise, but as a reminder to us all that in a tech world, it's our simple acts of human kindness that resonate the longest. Also, as a reminder, that new fintech has no monopoly of good blokes and, what's the female equivalent of good blokes, anyone? Nor do existing organisations have any lack of the same. So let's hear what Samad has to say about innovation bridge building. Let's get on with the show. Hi, Samad. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Thank you very much for having me.
So, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've had an interesting journey in your career so far, and the kind of variety that in the old days was seen as an asset, and which I believe is still an asset, especially in the fintech world, where one needs to have a feel for out of the box as much as in the box, and perhaps connecting those two concepts is something that you're doing about open innovation, which you can tell us later. But how did you get where you are today?
Well, I think like most things, it was a lot of luck.
And a mixture of bad luck as well.
Yeah.
Tripping over every now and then.
Exactly. I certainly have a few scars. I always tell people, looking back, that I'm quite proud of the fact that I started my career in 1999, writing for a new technology magazine that was looking at venture capital funding in the dot-com boom of that time. But as your history might tell you, we launched this magazine just as the dot-com crash was happening. So I spent my first years or so of my career meeting old hacks who would tell me, oh, you should have been here last year. You missed these great parties.
Yeah.
But thankfully, I also spent a lot of time speaking to CEOs of technology companies that had been massively overfunded and who were spending their time trying to convince me that their business was going somewhere. And sometimes they succeeded, but 9 out of 10 of them generally failed within a year of me writing something about them. And I very quickly started to realize that actually there was a lot of kind of PR and pomp around. But also that, unfortunately, the best technologies aren't always the best businesses.
That's an important point, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and I think it's a lesson for us to be aware of now, where so many new technologies are very easily understandable in the form of apps on phones and things like that. And I feel a lot of entrepreneurs and startups almost have their hopes and dreams fueled by large numbers of people who see their app, go, yeah, that would be really great, but don't really have any understanding of the business that needs to sit behind that.
Indeed, we were just talking just beforehand about whether the whole word fintech is becoming less valid over time as we're getting it sort of breaking into these different silos which don't have that much in common. You know, there's not a lot of common between P2P and Bitcoin. But my feeling on Bitcoin is that time is rather going by, or digital currencies in general, and they're starting to look more like your definition of something which is a really interesting and sexy technology. And they've less found the business case about, hey, somebody, if you use Bitcoins, you can do the following. You can fly home, or you can do something you could never do before. You know, that seems to be a prime example of a technology in search of a business. And of course, that's not stopping, you know, eight-figure, nine-figure sums of money going into the sector.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's that great quote that everyone's sort of quite familiar with now, which is along the lines of innovation's always slower than people expect, but has a much bigger impact than people ever thought it would when it occurs. You know, the funny thing is, again, going back to the 90s, was so many of the business models that were tried out and then failed then, many people then pointed fingers at, you know, petfood.com and all that sort of stuff. Those business models exist now.
Yeah.
And they did actually work in the end.
Yeah.
You can buy your clothes and trainers online successfully. But, you know, the thing is that ultimately for me, and going to the Bitcoin point, it's always about how people benefit, and ultimately business will find a way. It's just, and I think as we're going to get on to, it's the disruptive effect. It's difficult. Change is difficult for everyone.
Absolutely. In terms of technology quote, I hadn't heard about technology, but I've heard it many times about life, in that we all overestimate what we can achieve in the next 12 months, but massively underestimate what we can achieve in the next 5 years.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, the other point about tech versus business, it's not a value judgment. I mean, you can imagine a society where you get technical merit in the same way you get artistic merit, and it's not about the money, but to the extent that social interactions are all games with pre-described rules before we were born, the name of this game is business and is making profits and things like that. So,
yeah.
You know, having a shiny, exciting technology in and of itself is great, if you want to stick it in an artistic museum for tech, but of course you've got to turn it into the business point at some point.
Yeah,
in time.
But we have to also be aware that there's a third thing, in that new technology is changing the way people understand business and how to make money. It's changing the value chain between the consumer and the supplier. You know, just look at Google and this famous quote about Google, that Google's product is its customer. So their customers are people looking to search for things online, but they make money from those customers by selling adverts to them.
Yes.
And that kind of business model has been so powerful that I'd say 70% of startups I come across are using that model as in some way to stand up a business case that, well, we'll just sell the data or we'll sell adverts. And that didn't exist. That whole business model did not exist before.
No, absolutely. Well, maybe we'll come on to sort of startups and big co's. But I think the thing that I always think of, I mentioned the Taoists in the introduction, is going back to yin yang. One of the problems with Western thinking is that we've been completely corrupted since the time of Plato, and certainly the influence of Neoplatonics on Christian thought, and then Christian thought on scholastic thought, and then scholastic thought on scientific thought. In the West, we've got this great idea of the right answer. Whereas in Japan, in Zen, there's no principle, is no right answer. And in Taoism, it's yin and yang. So there's always two principles. I did a talk to a school earlier in the year about what I wasn't taught at school that I wish I'd been taught. And I used the example of salami. No matter how thin you slice it, it's got two sides. And you need to be cognizant of both sides. So as you say, that's one principle. The trouble is when you overdo one principle, call that the yang principle if you like, it doesn't particularly matter, then everybody goes around trying to imitate Google and then trying to be too yang. But they've forgotten the other side of the equation, which needs to be in balance with the opposing paradigm. So in terms of your career, I can see that it was very useful, if probably more painful than you're letting on at the time, having turned up after all the champagne had been drunk at the party, just when it was crashing, and your first few youthful and excited reports on these businesses going somewhere a year later, most of them hadn't. But on the other hand, that's probably a bit like a boot camp. You've had an accelerated training.
I mean, if anyone who knows me, I think I have a bit of a reputation as a bitter and cynical person. It's no coincidence that my Twitter handle is Bad Mood Masood.
I was about to quote that if you weren't, actually.
But, you know, ultimately I'm an optimist, but, you know, I try to put a lot of realism in there as well. And the point is, hype and cheerleading is all really helpful, but it's also damaging. And you just need to be cognizant of when someone who's giving you advice has credibility to talk to you about that, or whether they're just basically someone who's just excited because you're doing something new, which unfortunately isn't enough.
No, exactly. And in this very Americanized online world, I mean, all the platforms are American, they've sort of invented over there. This whole strain in the 20th century of positive thinking just shines through. And again, positive thinking is really useful. If you were always bad mood Masood, then one day you'll be depressed and never bother getting out of bed. So that needs to be offset with the positivity. But in all this kind of hypey stuff, it's all positivity. And it's never offset with the realism. So thinking about a gig where I worked alongside Accenture, one of the things that they did very well in that, and one of the things that clearly they do very well in general, is communicate sensitively but clearly the difficult and bad news to management. Saying, hey guys, look, you may think this, you may think it's all going to launch in 3 months' time, but... So we need to balance the two. So in terms of bridging these startups and existing organisations and making both innovate in slightly different ways, perhaps, maybe you want to talk about your definitions of the two types, or actually you have three types of fintechs. I have two types, one of which is competing with fintechs, the other which is helping them. What are your definitions of a fintech types of fintech?
Yes, the fintech term has been very helpful to define a space, but I think it's also often unhelpful because it sort of covers up the real diversity that there is amongst the innovators and technology and businesses in the space. So I define three types of fintech, and obviously it sort of aligns very much to, you know, the role I have and the company I work for. But the first type I describe as the disruptive fintech, which are the ones that get most of the headlines, the exciting sort of companies. And these are ostensibly businesses that want to sell financial services in a new way using new technology.
Yeah. So, for example, Zopa, RateSetter, TransferWise.
Yes, exactly.
CrowdCube.
Exactly.
They're doing financial services. They're new financial services companies.
And I'd put Wonga in there as well. Yeah. I think although Wonga has a bit of a tarnished reputation, I think for the fintech community, we shouldn't forget that actually one of the most successful companies in that space is Wonga. The second group is financial services technology companies that are selling financial services technology to any business, whether they are large incumbent banks, or they are brokerages, or they could be the new disruptive startups in the first group. And that would be companies like Mysis, Temenos, selling core banking systems, or it could be someone like Currency Cloud.
Right. Would you count Mysis? I mean, Mysis has been around for a while. Is that a fintech?
No, but my point is that there are technology
That's
companies
the
that sell
Absolutely,
financial
yes.
services technology yes. to financial services players.
Yes. Currency Cloud, I always think, is kind of, in a way, one of the insiders fintechs. You speak to somebody inside fintech, and they all have a lot of respect for Currency Cloud.
Mm.
But outside, as it were, in the mainstream media, you don't get as much flag-waving for them as some of the others.
Yeah, yeah. But then again, in the mainstream media, you don't really hear about this second group in general in the technology sphere.
Yeah.
It's the sort of the backroom technologies.
They're doing the plumbing, the electricity, the water, the gas, and all
exactly.
these things which are essential for a house or a building or a business.
But also, they're generally B2B, because they're selling to businesses, whereas the first group are selling to consumers generally.
Yeah.
The third group is similar to the second group, but they are what I call enterprise technology companies. And these are companies that sell technology to any business, but by virtue of the fact that financial services businesses tend to be very large and spend a lot on technology anyway, they tend to have large financial services client bases. And these could be big data analytics companies, accounting companies, it could be any sort of technologies. The examples here range from Oracle, SAP, Microsoft, to Salesforce.com, basically large enterprise technology companies. Now, my point is that of those three categories, currently, the market for those sort of things, it's interesting, while the first group of the disruptive fintechs get most of the press, by revenues, that's probably, and I'm estimating here, you know, roughly $100 million sort of market. The second group is probably revenues in the billions overall as a market. And the third group is certainly a $1 trillion market.
And just because I've got a very short memory, the principal dividing line between your second and third categories is what? What criterion distinguishes whether I put a kind of new tech firm, just to call it that, into category two or three?
So if the tech is something that could be used by any sort of business, so perhaps it's a content management tool, or perhaps it's technology to run your data centers better, or your network, perhaps it's a customer service technology, maybe it's a mobile app management technology, something like that, that could go into category three. Because any business, whether it's a telecoms company, an energy company, a government agency, or a bank, could use that to improve their business. if it's specifically a technology that is a financial services technology, so maybe it's a trading technology, maybe it's a mobile app for financial services, maybe it's a currency backend system or a core banking system, that would go into number two.
Right, okay. And so we have this division by that kind of functionality you described, and we also have a path over time in terms of the journey of a startup.
The interesting thing about these three types of fintech, for me, is that the first type is certainly the most exciting, certainly has the most potential to completely revolutionize the way financial services are delivered. And what I've seen over time is this sort of really interesting evolution. And if it's not too cheesy a segue, the evolution, I use a dinosaur to think about the financial services industry today.
Okay.
And if you think about...
I often felt like a dinosaur when I was working inside some of them.
Well, you think about a brontosaurus with a very long tail, a very large tummy, and a very long neck and a small head. I would say that, you know, when you're a startup, thinking about these three types of fintech categories, companies that want to sell financial services, companies that want to sell financial services technology, and companies that want to sell technology to financial services companies, if that makes sense. In all those three categories, you have lots of different startups. And if you're a startup and you want to start working with a large bank, or you think you're going to come up against them, if you think about the dinosaur analogy, it helps you to understand where you fit, but also what kind of relationship you can expect to have with the incumbent banks. So for example, if you are a Nutmeg or a Wonga or a TransferWise, you're probably nibbling away at the long tail of the dinosaur. And that's because the sort of services that those companies provide, they're certainly undercutting the banks. They're certainly providing something that the banks currently don't provide very well. But it's also in an area which isn't very profitable or easy for those banks to serve. So they tend not to be too worried about that. And you're kind of nibbling on the tail. And obviously, as you start getting closer and closer to the body, they're going to notice the pain a bit more. But, you know, I think where we are now, they're still nibbling at the tip of the tail.
Absolutely. So something like a Crowdcube, which does equity fundraising for small businesses, 150 grand. There's no way that a big bank in Canary Wharf could do that.
Yes, and it's not really of much interest to them. Now, it might become of interest to them, probably will become of interest to them as those fundraisings start taking more of the market, perhaps.
Yeah, and Cedars is getting into sort of seven-figure raises for Chapel Wines or whatever they're called, and then you can imagine it gets into eight-figure, and then, you know,
certainly
fairly soon you've nibbled your way most of the way up to the dinosaur.
But usually the sort of the values that these businesses are talking about are too low for the large banks really to find interesting. But let's say you're not actually competing with them. You're in maybe that second group or third group where you're providing technology that helps this large dinosaur do things a bit more nimbly or quicker or easier. And that could be technology that helps them follow the regulations a lot better, more efficiently, helps them cut costs in their processes. In this, you're kind of, what I say, tickling the tummy here, or you're helping them slim down the tummy. And, you know, the dinosaur there is probably, it's going to notice, but it's going to be quite happy because you're helping it lose weight, giving it a little tickle, and the dinosaur is going to be very happy about that sort of thing and so really want to engage with you. But if you're, on the other hand, starting to compete in areas which are quite close to the dinosaur's heart, or should I say near its head and neck, where it's actually finding its customers, it's actually taking food in and feeding the beast that it is. So for instance, platforms which are trying to compete for customers directly, then the banks are going to start noticing.
And the prime example is presumably something like LendingClub in the States, which IPO'd last month.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends again. LendingClub suggests it's more in the Crowdcube category in terms of, you know, the values.
The stat I saw was that, well, this is, okay, we're talking cross purposes as always, so you're talking revenues, and of course you're correct, but in terms of valuations, and that's kind of the market saying what future revenue is going to be like, I think I saw that LendingClub IPO, probably when it listed before it went through the roof, made it the 14th largest bank by capitalization. At the moment, it's going to really mess up your metaphor here. At the moment, it may not be eating much food, but it's getting quite big teeth. And it could potentially, in a few years' time,
teeth,
be
certainly
up in this category.
No, you're right. But I would actually probably look more like things like the personal finance management tools, like Simple.
Yeah.
Or Nutmeg, or these kind of things, where actually you're going direct to consumers and you're saying, we are going to provide you a much better way to deal with your money. Yeah. And you know what, we're going to just plug in your, you know, if you give us your logins for your various accounts, we'll just aggregate. And now this is where the dinosaur's seeing well, hang on, I'm losing my access, direct access to that income.
And if you're a traditional fund manager or, you know, sort of like the Rathbones or something like that, you know, you could be nibbled away fairly quickly.
Yes, yeah. So those kind of things the bank's going to attack. And we've seen with BBVA buying Simple, that's, a real
reaction to it.
So this is a kind of the analogy I use. I don't know how helpful it is.
Well, you've certainly programmed my mind ever more. Whenever I meet a startup, I'm now going to think of which part of the dinosaur it's attaching itself to.
The interesting thing is that what I've seen over the last 3 years is the startups that wanted to disrupt financial services or want to disrupt financial services, a few years ago, they were not interested in working at all with the incumbent banks. And the incumbent banks...
They were holier than thou.
Yeah. And the incumbent banks, it could be said, were sort of aware that something was happening, but not really doing much about it. I kind of liken it to the fact that both sides had this sense of self-entitlement. You know, on one side, you had the young hipsteries, we're going to revolutionize the world, perhaps the Russell Brands of the world, wanting to really, really shake things up.
I think Russell Brand wanted to shag things up, but that's another story entirely.
Well, yes, we should probably keep off that subject. But not wanting permission or any help. And the banks, on the other hand, sitting there in their castles thinking, well, you know what? We've got everything already. It'll be fine. These are just small little things. And we've seen a shift, actually, in opinions. Because, actually, both sides have something to give each other. Yeah. On one hand, a startup has agility. That's their one thing they have. And they have an interesting new idea. What they don't have is a proven ability to make it work. They don't have customers. They don't tend to have customers.
They don't have the brand reputation.
They don't have the brand reputation. But because they're small and they don't have those customers' reputation, they can also change very quickly. And that's the agility thing. And that's what large businesses don't have. On the other hand, large businesses do have some quite important things, like customers, lots of expertise around regulation, which is really important.
Very deep pockets.
Yes, very deep pockets. But also they have brand. I mean, whether people choose to believe it or not, banks are still quite trusted brands.
Yeah. If you give your money to HSBC, you don't worry about losing it. Now, that's partly because the government guarantees it. That's another subject.
Yes, but the point is that they still have quite trusted brands. And they also have a technology infrastructure, which parts of it, yes, are creaking, but is actually still in place and is doing a lot of the things that startups don't really want to build again from the ground up.
But your preaching is converted here, because my central picture on my logo is Tower Bridge. And I do see that going forward, financial services is going to be something that's between the two towers, you know, one tower being the old FS and the other tower being the new FS. Financial services is an activity that's in the middle. I mean, maybe that's a good point to move into explaining what you're doing at Accenture and how you're moving forward here. I mean, I mentioned that you're the lead for open innovation. I was wondering whether there's a lead for closed innovation in terms of your alter ego, or the yin and the yang. So what does open innovation mean then?
Open innovation in very general terms means doing new things with the ecosystem outside of your company's walls. So not, I suppose, I wouldn't call it closed innovation. I don't think anyone involved in innovation would call it closed innovation, but there is a way that you innovate where you basically are focused internally on your product.
I can think of an example of a very well-known, very large organization that recently started hiring about 5 million people to do its own risk system. Oh, we're going to innovate. We can do our own risk system internally for the whole organization rather than going and buying it from Murex or Sophos or wherever. So it does exist in certain pockets.
Yes, yeah. Certainly. And you know, banks have done a lot of sort of internal innovation. But open innovation is more about engaging with people outside. How Accenture defines it is really very similar, but we're actually working a lot with early stage companies, interesting startups, technology innovators that we can bring to our clients. Because going back to the fintech thing about the agile, nimble fintech challengers and the kind of incumbent, established but stable banks, they do need to work together. The challenge that both sides have with working together is that usually a small innovator has a point solution. It could be really, really good, it's really innovative, it's really exciting, but it solves one problem. The bank or a large corporate has multiple problems and they're all entangled with each other and they all have slightly different time scales, but they're all kind of wheels within wheels in terms of how they work. And an entrepreneur selling to a large corporate, that even if they get the CEO to sign up and go, this is perfect, we need this, it still has to go through a long, slow middle management process of approvals and timescales and shifting development cycles and all that. And someone needs to keep that on the priority list for that large company. And most startups don't have the funding.
I'm well aware. I went through this well over a dozen years ago with a large bank called ING Barings. And basically, I made my, exactly as you say, I'd made my sales pitch to the chief executive. And he said, yes, we want to do this. Oh, wow, great. So went home, you know, ordered more champagne, that kind of thing. And actually, until ink on paper, it was 6 months, because various middle managers started coming out of the woodwork saying, oh, yes, we must do this, but first, insert something, and then second and third. Yeah. And at the time, I was busy starving to death for 6 months.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I know the pain.
Everyone in the company could agree that this has to be done, and it could still take 2 years.
Absolutely.
Accenture sees itself in the perfect position in between here, because naturally, the sort of business we are working with these large clients, and we are very cognizant of their cycles and their complex decisions that they need to make. And we're always there trying to find out ways that we can help them.
You've got lots of experience of making things happen.
Yes.
People generally bring in a firm like Accenture because they've got some huge fuck up and it needs sorting out. And they rely on a firm like that to deliver.
I couldn't comment on that, Mike. Those were your words, but
no, I've seen it from the client side. I mean, you know, if you're a sort of CTO at BT and some huge division's got a huge problem, then you need, you know, an industrial scale reputation to come in.
Yeah.
You don't need to hire 100 different consultancies from 100 different agencies and try and get them all to work together.
Yes. And I'll be buying you that drink later.
Absolutely.
But
20% is fine.
The open innovation process is really about Accenture realizing that we are actually sitting in the middle here. It's in our interest to bring new innovative ideas to our clients.
Yeah.
It's in the startup's interest to be introduced to those, but it's also in their interest to have a partner that can actually go the long slog and understands that client really well and is basically doing the kind of long sales cycle for them and with them while not taking up all their time. So those are the sort of partnerships we're looking to make with startups.
And is this something that comes out of the FinTech Innovation Lab that you were running in your previous incarnation here?
Yes, I mean, to a certain extent. I mean, the FinTech Innovation Lab was never set up as a sales tool for us. It was always just for our clients to learn, for us to learn.
The experience of that has clearly informed you, though, in your current thinking.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly informed me. But the Open Innovation Program was set up over a year ago now in Silicon Valley, and we've been running it very successfully.
Oh, I see. The heritage isn't coming from the New York starting up the FinTech Innovation Lab. It's more from Silicon Valley this time.
There's a bit of both,
right,
to be honest.
Okay. So mixed parents.
Yeah, I mean, in a firm like Accenture, there are lots of different people who have lots of great ideas, and as soon as we realize when some align, we immediately join them together. So, you know, the Silicon Valley team are very much working with the New York team as well, and the same goes for London.
So for listeners to the podcast, both the small new startup end but also the large incumbent existing end, what kind of problems should they have to give you a call? They're listening to this and they think, this guy's got a good strategic grasp. Accenture understand the sort of big solid stuff, but also the more young agile thing. What kind of customers, if you put in that phrase, does your department or function want?
So on one hand, from the startup side of things, we want startups who are producing technology that would benefit large corporate businesses, because that's our client base.
And what will you do for them then? So one of them hears this and they think, oh, I'm one of them, and he gives you a call. What are you going to do for them?
There's a second criteria as well, which is you sell something in a way that Accenture can support. And bearing in mind that we sell consulting, IT services and implementation, management and outsourcing services, that's something that we can provide. If your technology could be used by a large corporate client, but literally they just need to press one button and it's integrated, there's very little we can do around that. We'd be very happy to introduce you to the client, but for a longer term relationship and for us to really help you, it's those sort of startups where they actually need consulting support.
Absolutely. And just pressing pause on that one, time is moving by. I think just to emphasize your message there, a number of startups are listening and thinking, oh, no, we don't need that. Well, my experience of having done precisely a mission critical strategic management system for banks at the highest level is that most of the art is in the implementation. You might have your piece of software you've invented in your room, like I did in Cannon Street, and you might understand it completely. You might think it's all plug and play. I even used to have that in my presentations. And you think it's plug and play until you've done a few clients, at which point you realise it takes several months to plug and play it.
Yeah.
And in that time, if you're a small organisation, you're probably then diverting yourself from your core mission, from your marketing, from your selling, and all that kind of stuff. And again, just to wave the flag on your behalf, the result of my journey through that process is that certainly, let's say, 5 years into it, I would absolutely see the need for what you're doing.
Yeah.
Day one, I'd have gone, now I can do that myself.
So what we can do for startups is if you come to us, we will take you through a thorough evaluation process, which basically tells you whether we think your technology is sound and whether it's something we could work with, whether your strategy is sound and whether it's something we could work with, and then finally, if we have any clients who might be interested. And we want to do this in a very short period of time, so it doesn't waste a startup's time, but also go back to them. And even if the answer is, you know what, we don't have any clients that would be interested right now, we want to give them enough so that they leave having learned something about the process and how they can actually go forward.
So it's almost like, in techie terms, it's almost like you're offering, in techie terms, an Accenture API. There's an interface to Accenture where they can find out where they can plug in, whether they can be with the parameters, and whether you can work together fairly quickly.
I'm not sure the API analogy works exactly, but...
It works for me, that's probably because I completely misunderstand the API.
But yes, it's a door into...
It's a docking port.
Yeah, it's a docking port. It's a door into Accenture, but it's not just a door in, it's also a door for you to get some advice back, and we both benefit from
which
that
which is the
very
process. Silicon Valley kind of stuff, which is offer value to people and don't worry about immediately commercializing it. Yeah. So that's what you can do for the small ones, and then just to wrap up then, what can you do for the big ones?
So for the big ones, I mean, a lot of our large clients are very interested in what's going on around them. I think we can help them make sense of what is the startup world, are the innovators out there doing, what are the trends, but what are the sort of most important things to be aware of. The thing with most people who want to get involved with startups realize pretty quickly that for every interesting company they find, there's another five that do the same thing in a slightly different way. And then suddenly you need to evaluate, well, which ones could we actually work with?
And if you go back to procurement and they take 6 months on it, by then the market will have changed anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think what we can provide is that buffer. We want our clients to be working with interesting new startup companies, but we want them to do it in a way that actually results in some outcomes. And, you know, we can help them with that either by helping speed up the process or by providing that buffer, they can actually rely on a partner who can, shall we say, skill up the startup and get them to a position, which means working together with them is effective. Remember, most startups, if one client comes to them and says, we'd like to do this, we've got a 6 month project for you to get involved.
They can be swamped.
They'll be swamped and they won't be able to grow other parts of their business.
Yeah. Well, that's what happened to me. I made decent money. This is in the sort of days before money had gone through the roof in terms of remuneration, but I still made over $1 million in a couple of years, which is enough for me. But when I was busy doing that, I had no time for anything else.
Yes.
So the business went on complete pause, which actually means going backwards.
Yes.
Good. Okay, I think that's all very helpful. I mean, time's gone by very quickly, as it always does.
Yes.
I think it's a very useful, and I'll write it up in the show notes, it's a very useful topology and description of the fintech sector, which has changed a lot in 2014 and will continue changing in 2015. I'm certainly much clearer now than I was before about what the role of open innovation is at Accenture and the kind of firms that you can help. And again, we started off by the fact that actually everything's about a business. And I can see that it's a really good business offering what you're offering in open innovation, both to the startups and to the old ones, because they both need to move, is my feeling. You know, as I said at the beginning, the new ones need to get more solid and the old ones need to get a bit sexier. And it's very hard to do that on your own. So good luck with the future.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. We are wild like the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.